Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. We have someone very, very special for you today. Alex, tell everybody who our special guest is.
Special in so many different ways. It's Bethany Moore, who is tour guide extraordinaire, historian, co-founder of the Great War Group. She is here to do World War One stuff today. Hey, Beth.
Hey, thank you. I feel really like, I'm really touched, like you said. I'm really special. Oh, you're both special as well to me. Love you.
Oh, thank you.
I'm so excited to be here, finally.
Possibly meant a different interpretation of the word special in ways as well, after you've had a bottle of wine, but yeah.
No. Yeah, well, the less said about that, the better.
Anyway, little Miss Yam Yam is here to big up the West Country, aren't you, and the Midlands?
Yes, the Midlands specifically. West Country's a bit out of my range, but yeah, Midlands, because I never feel like the Midlands gets a good rap, generally.
Well, so. This is because of all the Powell's battalions in the north, and the Scots get a lot of attention, and London, and you feel that the Midlands gets overlooked with its contribution to World War One.
Absolutely. And I think, for me, it's all started with my own personal research on this area during the First World War. For a lot of families in this area, a lot of them worked in industries that required them to stay at home. So we've got a lot of, you know, steel workers, coal miners, some of the first tanks. I know a lot of them were built in Lincolnshire, but some were built in my hometown as well. It was a really heavy industrial area. Most of the Midlands is, even still to this day, there's lots of industry still here. And a lot of them actually stayed. But so the majority of men from the Midlands you find are conscripted later on. But that doesn't mean to say that there weren't those who went, because there was. There was two whole territorial divisions of them. The 48th South Midland Division, and then the one that has become more of my area of interest, really, which is the 46th North Midland Division.
So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about one of these territorial divisions in the early war and what they contributed, which is going to be really good. So we're going to talk 1914-15, aren't we? Why have you been dragged personally towards these stories and the 46th Midland?
Yeah, it started with, like for most people, I think, with this year, when lockdown happened, we all needed to find ourselves something to do to keep us occupied. And I thought it would be a really good idea for the town where I live, which is called Rowley Regis, to create a list of all of the men who were killed from my town. It's not even today, it's not even a huge town. There's 12,000 people who come under the Rowley ward. So it's not a huge place even today. And even 100 years ago, again, wasn't huge. But the development of that list very rapidly growing highlighted to me just how many of them were in regiments that served in the 46th North Midland Division. Of the 333 who I've got on my list, a couple of them are still, I need to find some more details about, but of those 333, 27 of them were in the 1st 5th Battalion of the South Staffordshire Regiment. And again, the numbers are really big for other local regiments. We've got the 1st 6th South Staffords, and then Worcestershire's as well, 20 men in them who have been killed from this town. And it really developed. I wanted to find out exactly what happened to them, the stories of the of these regiments, and it snowballed into a bit more of a research project into the 46th North Midland Division itself. So these are all men from my local area. So obviously the county of the West Midlands now didn't exist 100 years ago. So where I live comes under Staffordshire, used to come under Staffordshire, which was North Midlands, but just down the bottom of the hill comes under Worcestershire. So this area, you've got lots of, it's very higgledy-piggledy, people are all over the place. But from this town, there was a lot of young men who, and older men as well, who became soldiers in these territorial divisions and were sent off to France and Belgium.
Can you tell us a little bit about the men and where they were from within the divisions?
Yes. Yeah. So the 46th North Midland Division. It was just called the North Midland Division originally. It was a territorial division from prior to the First World War in 1908 with the Haldane reforms. So these are men who are part-time soldiers. They're Saturday soldiers. They do a couple of hours once a month on a Saturday maybe, or of an evening. And they would be doing their training, much like the Territorial Army today or any reserve troops that we have. Very similar concept. So most of these young men, I have found out through personal research, are young men who, a lot of them work in the mines, coal mines. We've got a lot who work in the steel factories and a lot around this particular area of the Black Country in the West Midlands, chain making, so really big, heavy industrial work as well. And they're all really hard-working people, and they've joined as part-time soldiers. So they, when war is declared in 1914, in August 1914, because they're a territorial division, they aren't automatically sent out like the regular divisions. Any man who was serving in a territorial division was given the choice about whether they wanted to go and fight abroad or not. A significant majority of them wanted to go, and they formed the first line of the 48th, of the 46th Division's contingency. So any of the battalions that start with, so for example, the 1st, 5th South Staffords, the 1st, 6th South Staffords, they were all young men who had agreed to go abroad. The ones who had to stay behind, maybe for family commitments, maybe they were the main breadwinner, or just simply didn't want to go abroad in 1914, they were put into the 2nd, 5th South Staffords or the 2nd, 6th South Staffords. One of my relatives was actually in the 2nd, 5th South Staffords himself. He was a gunsmith, so he worked in factories with guns. So he stayed at home for a bit longer because he was needed, because he had the expertise to help make guns, which obviously were going to be so needed in the coming months and years. So it's a very broad group of men. In 1914, it's on their summer training in August, like a lot of divisions and units at that time. They were doing their summer training, you know, a week up in Northumberland or Scotland or Wales, wherever they were. And the North Midland Division was scattered all over the UK. And as soon as war was declared, they all came back to the West Midlands. And as a division, those who were going to go to France in the first wave were sent to Saffron Walden to complete their training to get them ready to send them across to France. They were still there right up until February 1915. So we're talking about 6 months-ish worth of training to get them up to the standard that they needed to be. On the 19th of February, they were actually inspected by King George V. King George V was a close friend of the divisional commander, who has the most fantastic name of anyone, I think we can agree, with the name of Major General the Honourable Edward James Montagu Stuart Wortley, which is a triple-barreled surname.
Very epic.
His story is just so incredible. I mean, you just have to look at the letters he's got behind his name. You know, he's got CB, CMG, DSO. He's a senior officer in the British Army for a very long time. He saw extensive action and service in the late Victorian period, Afghanistan, South Africa, Egypt, Turkey, Malta, the Sudan. He's been everywhere. Anywhere that the British Army was in the late 1800s, early 1900s, he was there. So he was a really experienced commander and, as we said, a really good friend of the King. When the King inspected the division on the 19th, he wished the division well. They hadn't been given an exact date of when they were going to go, but the fact that they'd been inspected by the King, the fact that he was wishing them well, and the fact that he had asked Stuart Wortley to keep writing to him on a weekly basis to tell him particularly how this division was doing, all the warning signs were there that they were going to be moving soon. And they were. the first advance units from the division landed at Boulogne on the 23rd of February, so only 4 days after the king had inspected them. And then latently the units began to arrive, and the whole of the formation of the division was in France by the 8th of March. They are actually the first territorial division to arrive complete in a theatre of war. So there were other elements of other territorial divisions that had been sent to other theatres of war, but the division as itself arriving in one whole piece, the 46th Division were the first ones to do that.
So we're looking at March 15, aren't we? Which means that the Western Front has settled down now into trench warfare, which is something that none of them would have had any experience in, much like all the other divisions arriving.
No, absolutely. And yes, they arrived in Ypres in the March, and it was very obvious that they'll need this additional training to what they've already had back in the UK. They'll need to know how to be soldiers in trenches, because again, I think the point is with the territorial soldiers is, yes, they're having some sort of training, and maybe some of them had been in the regular army and had moved over into territorial for the time. But the majority of them would not have served in a proper capacity, in a wartime capacity. You know, Britain hadn't been at war since the Boer War, the Second Boer War, which ended in 1902. So for some of them, you know, it's a great statement, isn't it? Some of them probably had never even been 5 miles from their home, except for the occasional training event. You know, they're going abroad. It's a completely new environment for most of them. So they would have had to have been trained to experience that warfare, the trench warfare, you know, the conditions that we know about and how trench warfare was conducted. And they settled in really, really well. There's some fantastic letters in the war diaries for the division war diaries, but then also in down into brigade and regimental level. Letters, fantastic letters from really now, 100 years later, iconic people, as it were, people whose names we know. So we've got Ingeville Williams, General Congreve as well. They're elements of the 46th Division have been placed with their units in and around Ypres, particularly for the 46th North Midland Division around Messines and Hill 60. They spend a lot of time in 1915 around there. They write these glowing letters, Ingeville and Congreve, about how good the division is, how what great shape these young men are in, because they're generally hardy workers who they were used to hard work. They were raring to go, wanted to be there, so they were fit, in good shape, well disciplined, and they were raring to go. They were ready to take part in what they had been trained to do.
Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the early actions?
Yeah, so for the 46th North Midland Division, 1915 up until September, and I'll get to that in a bit, is fairly quiet, shall we say. They're not thrown into the trenches straight away. They have this training period to start with in the south of the salient, and slowly get filtered in. So you can see in the war diaries, particularly regimental, regiment will get taken off for 2 or 3 days and will go and spend some time in the reserve trenches or communication trenches and then come back to the division. And then another one will go. And this happens for a good while, April at the very least, into May as well. They're moved into, and you can see there's plenty of pictures. I found pictures of these regiments as well, because it's not just, I'll keep referring to the South Staffords because they're my local regiment, but you've got the Sherwood Foresters, you've got Lincolnshire and Leicestershire as well. So these men from across the Midlands area, there are photographs of them spending time around Hill 60 in August 1915. And for those who are interested in the First World War and in Belgium, we know what Hill 60 was like. We know it was a very dangerous area to be in during the First World War. But they spend a lot of time in that southern sector, the Messines, Hill 60, and they're really developing. Their first big encounter, I suppose you could say, is in July. the end of July, the 30th and 31st of July 1915. They are in support of the 14th Division, which is quite topical for Alex and I of the Great War Group with our research that we're doing at the moment.
Yes, indeed.
It's really topical, which when I was rereading my notes, I was like, oh, finally. Like, I knew it made a connection somewhere. But the 46th Division were in support of the 14th Light Division at Hooge at the end of July 1915. And they were in support for that well-known liquid fire attack, the German liquid fire attack. This is the first time they're really seeing any sort of really intense action. You know, the Germans have attacked with this new weapon that no one had really encountered before. And it was a quite literally a baptism of fire for these young men. They do experience casualties, mostly because they're in support, not as much as like the 14th Division suffered, but they do suffer some casualties, and the war diaries, you know, dictate about the events that happened on that day.
The ones that get me about that attack are the ones that talk about the smell.
Yes.
Because it's meat cooking.
Absolutely. And that thought, I was thinking about this earlier, and not just for the young men that I've been researching, but all of the men who served, whether they were killed or whether they came home and lived to tell their tale, some of the things that would have been experienced are incomprehensible sometimes. You know, as a tour guide, I will take school groups and tell them what happened at the first one. You know, this is what happened here, and we've got poison gas and we've got tanks. But the thought of someone being doused in flaming petrol and burning, that smell, it's just so, it is almost incomprehensible. I struggle with it to this day, and I've been studying the First World War for years, and it's something I still struggle with a lot.
I think there's incomprehensible is the word, because there's, so the 14th Division, and this will be going in our project, don't worry, there's a mother whose son disappears on this day. And there's letters between the other Etonians and her afterwards. And what it is, so he's been caught up in this liquid fire attack, and she is obsessed with what's become of his revolver and why they can't just give it back to her, because she wants this keepsake of her son. And this sort of staggered progression of letters where they're trying to tell her without telling her that people were burnt alive, and you can't even tell who was who, let alone try and figure out exactly what's happened to one officer's rifle in all this chaos at that time.
And yeah, it's just
the last letter's pretty firm without being graphic, but just apologizes basically for their ineptitude and not being able to give this back to her.
I mean, in I was just having a look again in the war diaries, the general staff war diaries for the end of July, and it just talks about the sheer number of casualties that come through the dressing stations, not just for the 46th Division, but the 14th Division men as well. You know, the King's Royal Rifles, Rifle Brigade, the Sherwood Foresters for the Midlanders. It's a really, really horrific point in time. And I think it's a turning point. I think, you know, you talk about, yes, gas is a...
It comes a few weeks after the first gas attack, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the first gas attack was on the 25th of April 1915. So we're talking about 3 months later. But we've got the first use of poison gas by the Germans against the British allies. You know, like the French have used it, the Russians have used it. But it's the first time poison gas has been released. So they've had this experience of a new weapon that they hadn't experienced before, and the quick developments in how they can protect themselves against that. 3 months later, they're dealing with liquid fire and flaming petrol. You know, it's understandable why these developments so quickly, why the weapons become more and more nasty. You know, why the British start using gas against the Germans themselves, why we end up with developing tanks in a way. You know, it's always about trying to get on the other foot, get the enemy on the back foot. and all these developments, you know, you can talk about and say, well, wartime for medical practices is not good, but lots of medical developments happen in wartime. But then you think about as well the practical elements of weaponry warfare, weaponry and tactics, and how rapidly that has to change as well to encounter such things as liquid fire, because you're not going to win against liquid fire as a normal human being. Someone starts aiming that at you, you haven't really got much of a chance, have you? So it's a generally unpleasant experience for them, and I think a true test of what is to come for them.
After their experience in Belgium, they moved down to France. What happens then?
Yes, so they've completed what's kind of been their training period. So they've had 6 months under their belt, and they get moved from Belgium. They've spent a lot of time in Belgium, well, all their time in Belgium, and are being moved to a new area. They are moved to the area around the city, the town of Luz and Lens, in northern France. The Battle of Luz is getting underway when the division is moved down there. So it starts on the 25th of September, 1915. And, you know, the Battle of Luz, I won't go into that element of it so much because I want to talk about the Midlanders. And they come in a bit later. But they are moved down to that area in preparation for them taking part in the offensive at Luz. You know, the Battle of Luz is, in essence, the first true British assault on the Western Front. It's a smaller scale attack. It's a large scale attack, but it's in support of the French who are fighting in the Artois. Because obviously the French are the bigger partner for the Allies. You know, they provide much more men and quantities of you know, in numbers of men, weaponry and what have you. But it's a real chance for the British to show what they've learned, mostly in Belgium and in France as well, and to really give their troops a good going out, as it were. So for the Midlanders, you know, they're moved down at the end of September. This is an area that's completely unknown to them. They've not been there before, but it's not completely unfamiliar. This area around Luz and Lens, for those who know that part of the battlefield, again, it's a very heavy industrial area. There's lots of coal mining in this area, and again, industry. So it's like a social aspect. It's not an unfamiliar terrain. You know, if you go and you see the slag heaps that are dotted around that part of northern France, that's something that would be quite common and familiar to the North Midlanders. So socially, something they're quite familiar with. But from a military perspective, it's completely new. And they don't have much time to prepare at all for what is to come. The 46th North Midland Division has been tasked with, at the beginning of October, an attack on what is called the Hohenzollern Redoubt. If you ever hear of redoubts in the First World War, you've got the Schwaben Redoubt down on the Somme, the Leipzig Redoubt as well. These are fortified strongholds that the Germans have invested a lot of time in and a lot of material and men in. So you may have bunkers, barbed wire, nests, machine gun nests that cross over against each other. It's a really, really heavily fortified, strong position that the intention is you're not going to lose that territory. For the North Midlanders, there had already been attacks on the Hohenzollern Redoubt with other units, and it was backwards and forwards from the middle of September into October. It was backwards, forwards, with trying to take this territory. For the North Midlanders, their attack, this is their first attack in a large-scale offensive. This is their chance to show what they can do. And their attack was to regain the land that had been lost at the Hohenzollern Redoubt. There were still elements of British frontline, new frontline position in the redoubt itself, but the intention was to take the whole of the redoubt again, so that it was as better position to be in as the winter months start to roll in. When you are fighting an offensive, you want to be in as good a position as possible for the winter, because you don't generally fight in the winter. You know, it's time to hunker down. You then strengthen your positions and do what you need to do to get through the winter. So they needed to be in a really good position, because we are coming to period middle of October where the offences are starting to wrap up. You know, we do see fighting into November, but it's starting to wrap up. So this offensive needed to happen, and they needed to take that land. So they had been doing their training, as we said, for the last 6 months, and they're really raring to go. They really want to show what they can do. And you can see it again in the war diaries. There's a lot of, they're really, really interested. They're really passionate about it. One of the chief of the division's general staff, Lieutenant Colonel Game, he issues a memo, and it really does make for quite stirring reading. I can't read all of it word for word because it is a very, very intense note. And it's very, very long as well. But he uses all these really impassionate words, and he talks about the task that is to come and how they can prove themselves to the rest of the British Army. And I can't think, they must have been, certainly I think their spirits would have been quite high. You know, it's finally a chance to show what they could do. On the 7th of October, so about 6 days before the attack was planned, the divisional commander, Stuart Wortley, he had received the plans for the attack on the 13th. And he had made it known to his corps commander, General Haking, and also even to Haig as well, who was not Field Marshal Haig and not Commander-in-Chief at this time. He had made it known to the both of them that he didn't want to proceed in the way that the plan had been planned out. He was a really, really early advocate for what those of us who were interested in the First World War would come to know as the bite and hold technique. He was really keen on attacking the position first with bombers. So bombs were what grenades were called during the First World War. So men who have been trained specifically to use grenades to their best effect, bombs, he wanted the bombers to attack first in order to take the position in a concise manner, consolidate that position that they've just taken, and then move forward. So it's a really, really early form of what becomes the bite and hold technique that we see later on at the Somme and on to Passchendaele as well. So he says this, and this is September 1915, so he's really quite early. However, his plan was not authorised by the corps commanders, and they were to stick with the plan that had been put in place. On the night of the 12th of October, the first elements of the division, so in this case it was the 1st 5th Battalion of the South Staffords, were sent forward to start relieving the Guards Division, who had been in the frontline position at that time. However, the Germans had some sort of understanding that something was about to happen, because they were shelling the positions, which caused the relief to be pushed back and delayed. The troops, the South Staffords, couldn't get forward, and they just kept adding delay, delay, delay. All of these delays meant that the relief wasn't completed until 6 o'clock on the morning of the 13th. So we're talking right on the morning that the offensive is about to happen. The troops are still not in their positions correctly because of congestion in the trenches, German shelling, and also small German attacks on the position itself. So they can't get into place as quickly as they needed to. And the plan was to go as follows. 12 o'clock, an intense artillery bombardment was to begin, which was to include smoke as well. So smoke, incendiary shells, explosive shells. An intense bombardment was to happen for at least 2 hours, until 2 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, to keep the Germans either below ground, to suppress them, poison gas was to be released at 1 o'clock. The artillery bombardment was to finish at 2 o'clock, and then the assault was to begin at 2:05. And things were already starting to go wrong before the attack had even started. It was noted throughout the bombardment that the artillery did not seem to be having an effect on certain German positions, which went by the name of Big Willy, South Face and Dump. German snipers were unaffected by the artillery. They were able to target the South Staffords in particular, causing a lot of damage by shooting at the troops. They managed to take out three periscopes in 20 minutes, so the 1st, 5th South Staffords couldn't see over the trenches to see what was going on in the positions, to pass messages back to the artillery and whatnot. And war diaries across the division seem to suggest that the gas and smoke cloud, by the time 2 o'clock rolls around, had actually dissipated, leaving the attackers, the North Midlanders, open and vulnerable without any cover attacking in the middle of the day. Rather than attacking in the early hours of the morning or at dawn or dusk, they are doing this bang smack in the middle of the day. And they are now without any cover. So the attack starts at 2:05. Within minutes, it's really obvious there are very, very serious issues occurring across the whole of the attacking front. So as the right flank move forward, the first line is actually the 1st, 5th Battalion, the North Staffords, and they only manage to advance 50 yards before they come under machine gun fire, rifle fire, and they never reach their objectives. That battalion suffers losses of 19 officers and 488 men, almost exclusively in that first attack. For the entire division, most of their casualties happen within the first 10, 15 minutes of this attack taking place. The 1st, 5th South Staffords don't fare any better, but one of the commanders, the company commander in that regiment, sees what's happening and orders his troops not to advance. He says, this isn't the time to do this, let's wait, and they waited for more support. However, another company in that regiment didn't get that message and didn't see what had happened to the North Staffords and got up out of their trenches and began to advance, suffering much the same fate. They're just wiped out, basically. If you ever go to the Loos Memorial and look for the South Staffordshire Regiment, they're completely wiped out. And of the stories that I found, the four men, I think I've managed to pinpoint more or less what's happened to them. And these men are all in the first wave for the 1st, 5th South Staffords. So they're in that phase where it's really, really just gone completely wrong. They never really have much of a chance to get anywhere. They don't get to any of the positions that they were supposed to. And it's just a real, for me, I'll discuss it a bit later, I'll discuss a bit more, but it's just a real exercise in how necessary not to do it, because there's just so many casualties. As I said, almost all of the casualties for the division for that day are within the first 10, 15 minutes. So you can imagine it would have just been a bloodbath.
There are a lot of fallouts among the generals after the offensive in Loos. How does this affect the division?
Yeah, the division have really come off this offensive really quite badly. They're, as we said, again, comparatively new to the Western Front. It's their first involvement in a large-scale assault. And they suffer 3,763 casualties. Again, most of those in the first few minutes. Stuart Wortley had obviously presented his plan in the week before, which had been rejected by the corps commanders. And he wasn't happy. There's lots of notes in the war diaries of, you know, the after-action reports talking about very factually what happened. But there are references in personal letters and in other areas as well that there is some animosity brewing, which come 1916 will prove very, very disastrous for Stuart Wortley. He has a major bone to pick with Haig. They do not like each other for a lot of reasons. Haig is reported as saying that he does not believe that Stuart Wortley should be in charge of a division. He's quite open about it. There is letters from people like a man by Josiah Clement Wedgwood of the Wedgwood family, of Wedgwood fame, and they're writing lots of letters between each other about how Stuart Wardy doesn't know what he's doing, and he should never have been in charge, and his plan didn't work, they wouldn't work, and it's a very, very, very poor relationship. It was before the offensive started, and as well with Haking as well for Stuart Wardy, there was a lot of animosity there, and this was exacerbated by the outcome of the action at the Horizontal Redoubt. For Stuart Wardy, he blamed Haking for the attack, and how the plan had gone when he had presented another plan himself. He blamed Haking for it, but couldn't get anywhere with his complaints because Haig supported Haking's decisions. And going forward, you know, they've lost a lot of men, the division have. They need a period of rest. They need to be taken out of the front line to bring their numbers back up to strength and to just recover. Within 6 weeks, they've been ordered to go to Egypt, with most of the division having left France by Christmas, and they arrived in Egypt in the middle of January 1916. However, within just a few days in Egypt, the division, if you look at the diaries, it's not even a week. They are ordered back to France, where the division then remained for the rest of the war. And they spent a lot of time around places like Vimy Ridge before being moved down onto the Somme, around Goncourt and Fonquevillers, which is another story for another day. The 1st of July for 1916 for that division is another story that unfortunately Stuart Wardy does not come well out of, possibly because of what happened on the day, although I think that's a rather unfair assessment for the division, but partly because of his own personal disagreements with certain people who basically thought he shouldn't be in charge of a division anyway. So Loos really is the turning point, not just from the perspective of they've lost a lot of men, it's a baptism of fire, it's not something they've ever experienced before, but also because we start to see the changes that lead to Stuart Wardy being removed from his office later next in 1916.
Beth, thank you so much for coming on to give us an overview of a territorial division at the beginning of the war. So much is mentioned and so much is said of the Kitchener divisions because they are completely separate because Kitchener didn't rate territorials and wanted to start with something new. So it's good as well, and to do one from a part of the country that, quite rightly, as you say, doesn't get as much attention as everyone else.
And I'm happy to come on and tell the rest of the story another day if you'd like, because they certainly, by the end of the war, they redeem themselves, to be sure, by the end of the war. So I'd be happy to talk about that again, if you'll have me.
Of course. Join us tomorrow when John White Greenlee will be telling us why medieval England was obsessed with eels. No, you haven't heard that wrong. We're talking about medieval eels, and there's so much more to it than I thought was possible. And then down the pub, to mark the inauguration, we will be discussing and debating the worst president in US history. John Jordan will be judging tomorrow, which means that all of the British contestants have got to argue to an American as to who their worst ever president was. And we banned the T word because it's just no fun.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them, so don't forget to go in. You can do as little as $1 a month, and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe.